We are told from a young age to pursue love. Self-love, romantic love, divine love. But what exactly is love? And whether you can figure that out or not, how are we supposed to work towards it? Well, Cleo Wade is the right person to talk to. She's a poet whose latest book is called Remember Love, Words for Tender Times, and she thinks a lot about love. Our conversation led down many paths. We talked about balancing the beauty and catastrophe of the world, appreciating pain, staying present, and the resurgence of poetry. I hope you will love this conversation as much as I did. This is a bit of optimism.
You are a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find funny about having poets in our modern day is it sounds medieval.
It really does.
Like you're a blacksmith, you're a cooper,
yeah.
And you're a poet.
Yeah.
We have a poet laureate in this country. There's a poet laureate in the UK. And like if somebody said, we have a poet laureate, you'd be like, we do? Like we still have one of those?
Yeah.
Didn't we get rid of those in the 1800s?
Yeah.
And so I'm fascinated by what it feels like to be a poet in a modern day where it doesn't seem to be a thing anymore. Like kids don't say, one day I'm going to be a poet. Right.
Yeah, and it was hard actually, 10 years ago when I was writing Heart Talk, I feel like I sold my first book door to door like a Mary Kay salesman. Like I feel like I sold every single one myself.
Yeah.
Because no one understood the concept even at the time. It's like people know poetry, but it had just dropped out of popular culture.
Yeah. It's really interesting, right? Art should reflect our times. And it seems like poetry is one of those media that got forgotten, where if somebody says, I want to be a musician, you're like, oh, good, yes, wonderful. I want to be an artist. I want to be a painter. Oh, good. If you say, I want to be a poet, people look at you like you're dropping out of society. And so I love that you're part of this movement to bring back an art form that it's quite accessible to everyone.
The thing is that – and you have to know this as a writer, no matter what you're writing.
Yeah.
You are never – having a thought that has not been had before, ever.
Yeah.
You just aren't.
Yeah.
And if you search for that, you'll never put anything into the world because it'll never be perfect enough to make that unreachable and untrue thing true. No matter what poem you have read, there's some version of it in the Quran or the Bible.
Yeah.
Like it is a sense there has been a way to communicate.
Yeah.
People have wanted to communicate in stories and in emotional expression.
In verse.
So I think what you notice more is when something comes through the center, it's actually because people are focused on how do I communicate in a way that people can hear right now? And that's really important. It's important in romantic relationships, right? Like do you ever have that thing where you want to tell someone something, whether it's professional or romantic or a friend, and you're like, well, I have to wait till they can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as a writer, for me at least, my process is I try to write in a way that I feel that people have the capacity to hold the information. I don't think I'm giving new information. I don't think if I write about love or vulnerability or whatever, that does not exist in a zillion different iterations throughout time and even currently. But what I'm always focused on is how can you hear this? I think Taylor Swift does that. I think Bob Dylan did that. At a very specific time in culture, you have to believe that those people spoke to an energy, not just an idea, because there's just –
what does that mean?
I think it means – I kind of look at it like when I think about Taylor Swift –
You mean like a zeitgeist? Is that like
you
capturing a moment in time?
Part of what I feel like when you see people like Bob Dylan, John Lennon, Taylor Swift, it's almost as if how they release things, what they release, what they're saying – it's like they're turning a radio dial, finding a spiritual attunement to what is this kind of undercurrent where everyone can have a completely different life experience, but somehow this message and how it's delivered just works. I think a leader of a Christian megachurch is able to do that. Like they have something where they are so tapped in energetically to their community.
Yeah, their listeners.
I feel something beyond the stories they're telling me. There's a feeling underneath I connect to.
Two questions. Do you remember your first poem you ever wrote?
Okay, so I went to a creative arts summer camp in Louisiana, and I got a scholarship. But poetry was something you could take in fifth period, and everyone said that you got to take a nap if you went to this. And really, what I realize now is that she was just asking us to meditate. And this woman, who's my first poetry teacher, and she's like, I just want you to write something on the page that doesn't make sense. Mm. I want you to think of every color you've ever seen a bird in, and now describe the one bird you've never seen.
Mm.
And that so deeply hit me as a kid that, like, I tell the story to this day. And I remember describing a rainbow bird. And I remember thinking, like, here's all these things about this bird I'd never seen. And that was my first poem I'd ever written. It was about a bird I'd never seen. I don't think that if she wouldn't have given me that early definition of there's no good and there's no bad, there's only you, because it's just what you've never seen.
This is such a lovely thought. There is no right or wrong or good or bad. There's just you.
Yeah.
And I think we're social animals. We live in community. We can't help ourselves but compare. I mean, yeah. that's the insidiousness of social media, right? And we do it all the time. We do it with jobs, right? Grass is always greener. Like somebody else's job is always better than my job. Yeah. Somebody else's partner is always better than my partner. Somebody else's vacation is always better than my vacation. Yeah. We can't help ourselves. You know, Teddy Roosevelt said, you know, comparison is the thief of joy.
Yeah. I can't write in comparison to so many people and so many poets. Do you know what I mean? Like Maya Angelou couldn't write if it was about what her background was or what was the right or wrong way to write. Do you know what I mean? She was a dancer. She was a singer. She was like an entertainer, but she had something to say in a really unique way to say it. But it was not because she had the background of a scholar. Like Oprah was – she kind of was a beauty queen at first. You know what I mean? Like she had a very her way to be in community with people in this kind of light and leadership.
But there's a limit, right? And I think that all of these things have real definition that sometimes become distorted, like the discussion about boundaries.
Right.
You know, boundaries are important, but they're not about pushing others away or using boundaries as a means of like shirking responsibility.
Yeah.
And I think this is another one, which is, you know, like somebody who's mean to somebody else and says, just speaking my truth. Yeah. I'm like, that's not what that means.
It's so crazy because a couple of days ago, somebody asked me something like, you know, we all struggle to be honest with each other. You know, like I was having a hard day the other day and someone said, how are you? And I just immediately said, I'm great, thanks. Like, and she's like, should I have just told them the truth? And I was like, well, like.
Context.
And you have to take responsibility for your energy. Like, because like you are an adult. That's what I say. Like, what is mine to hold? What is mine to give away? What is mine to let go of? What is mine to share? Because those are ways that we take responsibility for being like another adult in the room and knowing that our life story is not the center of anybody else's life stories. I don't think it's helpful. I don't think it's something that is likable, even just for those who desire to be in community in a way where we get to like enjoy each other's company.
Yeah.
To emotionally dump, trauma bond, erase other people's like boundaries or capacity.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really important. My kind of question is always like, well, where can honesty, integrity, and responsibility of self all be held?
Let me tell you where my mind goes.
I'm scared.
There's a metaphor here. I'll meet somebody for the first time and I'll put my hand out to shake their hand. Nice to meet you, I'll say. And they put their arms out. They go, I'm a hugger.
Right? I hugged you today. Now I'm embarrassed.
No. It's fine. It was perfectly.
I did that. No, I literally did that.
It was perfectly mutual. But the point is somebody will come in and say, I'm a hugger. As if it's a game of rock, paper, scissors.
Right.
That hugging beats handshaking.
Yeah.
And if I say, well, I'm not, I'm an asshole.
Yeah.
But this is, I think, the same construction, which is just speaking my truth. I don't think it's appropriate right now, or I don't want to hear it. I'm busy with something else, or I don't have the mental capacity to deal with whatever it is you're dealing with right now, and I'm sorry. But this idea that my truth is like the hug that trumps all else in the room, you know, that it's a game of rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah.
And I think the idea of helping people be in touch with their emotions and be self-aware, so good. Look, I'm in this as well. You and I are sort of two sides of a similar coin, which is we want people to love their work and demand good leadership and live love and be yourself and be aware and, you know, speak your truth and all of these magical things. And the one little piece that often gets left out in all these messages is, and you live with other people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are other people in the room, in your life, in the world that have their own stuff.
Yeah.
And yes, you have to be you, but you have to be sort of, you know, aware of our surroundings. And I think that's the piece that's missing.
Yeah.
And I'm going to bring it back. Your work on love, and I there was one thing you wrote, and I'm going to screw it up, which I loved, which is self-love and the practice. What was it?
It's if self-love says I love you, self-care says prove it.
That's it.
Yeah.
Right? I think there's sort of like the action of like living in a world with other people. And the work of love, though there is an internal love and a self-love, the even better kind of love is the shared love. But to have just self-love with no shared love, I'm not sure that's healthy. And you can survive lack of self-love or struggles with self-love if someone else loves you.
Well, and I think what we have to ask ourselves, and, you know, bell hooks did such amazing work and really asking us to define love. You know, she had a great definition of love, and she really, like, you know, I think spent most of her literary career saying, define it, define it, define it. So you know when it's present, you know when it's not. And to me, if I'm putting a word in my definition of love, I'm going to put the word safety. Mm. I don't feel that love is happening if safety is not present, if feeling safe is not there. I don't think that we are safe when we are alone, and I think that community is essential to safety. So if I'm chasing after, looking for, wanting love for myself or anyone I care for, I know that the only way to have safety be possible is for community to be present, which is why you probably
this
it's
is
not
so good.
It's not a surprise that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. preached everything towards beloved community. He's like, beloved community solves all our problems. Wanting like beloved community, like where love is happening between all of us. And then if we can, you know, kind of pick up on bell hooks and say like, well, then what's love? Who pauses to define love? And recently it was really interesting because I think it was my friend DeRay. He posted something that said, it was someone's tweet, and it said, you know, we need to normalize not calling everyone our friends. Some people are colleagues. Some people are school friends. Some people are this. Da-da-da. And I was thinking about how we should also do that with love, like this idea that we are either in love with someone or we are not. The second day I was with him, I just knew I was in love. Like, can we start to pull distinctions? Like, I was deeply infatuated. I was maybe even obsessed. I wrote a lot about heartbreak over the last couple of years, and at some point, I wrote something that said, like, I'm not even sure it was love. It was more like something that demanded you call it love. Every single time in reviewing the 10 years that I, like, thought about, I always called it love, and it was always something else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's so good. Love and safety are great. I love that. Let me change subjects on you. You said something when you walked in which piqued my interest. You said the world is just beauty and catastrophe.
I just feel like, especially right now, and I really hate investing in these polarities, right? Because this idea of like, we have become obsessed with right and wrong, so much so that we don't allow inner contradictions, which is the nature of our being. I think with people right now, it's just that I don't know if there's just this like kind of groundswell of like whether it's the culture we're living in where we're not really having enough space to process, and everything maybe feels really overwhelming and there's a lot of space to go to numb, and I don't know what it is, but how things are hitting feel like the most beautiful thing in the world or the greatest possible catastrophe.
But aren't all times beauty and catastrophe? What makes our time so different that it feels like it's only beauty and catastrophe? Because birth and death have existed since the dawn of humankind, and there's war and there's magic and,
you know, every kind of generation on Earth likes to believe that their generation is the time where the one like big
this
change
is
happening.
Yeah, exactly.
When really we have just consistently had trouble in change in a consistently changing world. And so for some reason, it just never stops being surprising. It's like that. It's like you have that like one friend or one person maybe you work with, and they always do the same thing you fucking hate. And then you act like you're outraged every time. And you're just like, I just can't believe it. And you have no idea why you can't believe it. Like when I say the nature of us is a certain way and the nature of the world is a certain way. Do you know, we are seasonal. This world is seasonal. We are fragile. This world is fragile. We have this kind of weird sturdy and toughness. The world has freaking oak trees that survive every hurricane in New Orleans. Like, it's crazy.
I think this is where your work lives, and I think why your work resonates with so many people, because we have minimal control over beauty and catastrophe, and you can't simply change your mindset. When there's a birth of one of, you know, yourself or your best friend, you can't look at this child and be like, oh, but the world they're going to live in is horrible and climate change, and this is a time to be mournful at the birth of this child.
Yeah.
And at the same time, when you lose a loved one, you can't in the moment say, oh, but, you know, they lived a full life and isn't it magical? Like, we can't turn catastrophe and beauty into the other with our mindset. Yeah. However, the space in between, this is where I think we have more control.
Yeah.
And this is where I think, as I was saying, where I think, because you were like the patron saint of love. And I guess in modern day, you were the promoter of love. And I think that is about an attitude and that is a practice that if you bring that to the middle, that's where life exists.
So as you were saying that, something I was thinking about is this idea of what I'm saying, like, we have like only beauty and catastrophe. And perhaps that's what I mean, our main catalyst in a way. So for example, when I was talking to you about that, I was saying that, you know, my best friend's father passed a couple of days ago. And, you know, you have the moment in the time of the catastrophe. And then that in between is actually like, okay, who's in the kitchen making sure mom gets some cinnamon raisin bread in the morning? Who's keeping the notes of, like, you know, everyone who sent flowers? So life flows like giant pebbles that get dropped into a water. And then everything in between is probably that ripple of like flow you're finding in the doing and the being. And so it's a fresh theory because I did just...
You just said it about 10 minutes ago.
Thought about it 10 minutes ago. But like, I was just kind of thinking about it in the car. I was like, wow. And then, for example, you know, I have a rough travel day home and then I get home and my three-year-old crawls in my bed, you know, and puts her hand on my face and says, I miss you so much. Beauty, right? My nervous system kind of mellows out and I can kind of get into today.
Since I learned about this thing called the infinite game, I've adopted this mindset of the infinite mindset. Mm. And the original definition of finite and infinite games came from this magical philosopher and theologian named James Carse. Mm. Basically, where I've learned to adopt the infinite mindset is nothing is final. Everything is simply a moment on a continuum, and to think of life as a continuum. Yeah. And so, I mean, I'm thinking out loud with you now, to say that life is catastrophe and beauty, that neither of those things is permanent. This is why to love beauty is important because it's going to go away. But at the same time, there are always lessons and magic that comes out of catastrophe and tragedy and loss as well.
You know, it's really crazy. My friend's mom said this to me one day. I was talking to her and her daughter, both of whom had gone through a divorce. And her daughter said something about her divorce and her mom got kind of emotional, feeling like sad about her pain. And her daughter says, you know, oh yeah, the pain, the pain. And her mom says, you know, but the pain's okay. And I said, why is the pain okay? Because I never felt like I fully subscribed to that idea of like, you can't understand pleasure without pain. I don't think that's true. I think like what feels good feels good. I don't think like,
it's not a comparison.
I don't think I need to know like what my burning my hand on the stove feels like in order to like know how delicious chocolate ice cream is. Like, I just don't. I don't think so. So she said, pain is the only thing that makes you question life. She goes, you know, when something awful happens, you say, why God, why me, why this? And she's like, and you can't actively decide where you want to go or what you want to be doing without asking questions. She goes, when you're happy, you don't think. And that's why happiness is so great. And I remember being like, whoa, that finally made that kind of distinction between pleasure and pain resonate for me. Because I was like, yes, of course. Like, it's actually like, damn, I would have never asked. She's like, you don't question anything in joy. Thankfully, you're not being like, why am I so happy?
You know,
like
you're
feeling it. Yeah. And she was just like, pain will create your spiritual relationship. You know, most people who have these really beautiful spiritual relationships to whatever come from a space of rock bottom. It truly comes from getting to their bottom, seeing they have no foundation, and then asking themselves how to create one.
Yeah. But let me play devil's advocate for a second here, right? Because to your point that when we're in joy or bliss or whatever you want to call it, and we cease to ask questions, we think to ourselves, this is it. I found passion. I found purpose. Here it is. Mm-hmm. This is it. I'm done looking.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Whereas when we're in that extreme pain, we also give up sometimes. You know, like you have a horrible breakup.
Yeah.
You know, I'll never find love,
yeah.
Which of course is not true.
Yeah.
And so I think there's blindness in both extremes. And though I think the idea of in pain we ask questions and there's blindness and bliss, which I think is true, I think there's also false narrative that this is the end of the road on either side. Like, I found the thing. Nope. This too shall pass.
Yeah.
And I will never. Nope. That this too shall pass.
Mm-hmm.
I think being present is not getting lost in either one. Yeah. It's moderating, right? And maybe this is cynical. I believe that life is always balanced, mm-hmm. right? And I talk about this in terms of entrepreneurship very often. In the corporate world, your lows are not that low, but your highs are not that high. It's balanced. Where if you choose an entrepreneurial journey, your highs are so high, but your lows are so low. It's right. always balanced. Yeah. And it's not better or worse. It's just a question of where would you prefer to live your life? Like what degree of balance do you want to live? Because you're going to get the balance. And I think this is the case here as well, which is instead of living life where the highs are so high and I become so blind and the lows are so low that I become so blind, that if I want the lows to be moderated, in other words, don't worry, you'll be okay,
yeah.
then I can't leave the high all the way over here. I don't have a choice. That'll tip the balance. So to moderate the lows, I have to bring the highs in.
And that's also like an amazing pathway of embodied resilience, right? Like what you're also explaining is how to maintain resiliency in both, right? Because that's your mindset for what happens. And so it's really interesting to kind of think of it as highs and lows.
Mm. Can you tell me a specific story, something you've done at any point in your career? It doesn't have to be in this current form as a poet. Could have been any time in your life. A specific story, something you've done in your career that you absolutely loved being a part of it. And if every experience in your life was like this one, you'd be the happiest person alive.
When I think back on it, I think probably of my first book tour. Yeah. I like brought all of my best friends on the tour.
Mm.
And when I tour, I really like to just be in community, role modeling community.
Mm-hmm.
And so I talk to them about their life. And it's kind of like this. It's like we don't talk really about one specific thing, or it feels just like a conversation that is vulnerable and loving and kind of fun. And so on the book tour, I remember it having this book tour stop that was three of my girlfriends, and we just all had this amazing conversation. And it really felt that like it was almost like we were in our group chat talking, but every person in the audience was just also in it.
Mm.
You know, it was me and it was all other Black women who were on the panel, and it was mostly Black women who were in the audience. Mm. And it was just a really like, I remember being like, wow, I would write books for the rest of my life if it meant that I could always have them be a vehicle for creating community like this. It was just sitting in a room and everyone's invited to be your friend.
Mm.
And I really feel like I didn't think I would be a writer when I was growing up, and I didn't know that I would certainly write poetry in even 2015 or whatever year it was, and that when that was not a real job. But I did feel in that moment that I was like, oh, it brings me here to this room. And you feel it, you know? I mean, I was in D.C. 3 days ago, and someone stopped me on the street. Her name was Morgan, and she was there. And she's like, that freaking tour stop with like Simone and Brittany and Diarra. Like, I didn't remember saying this, but she said that I'd open the tour by saying, like, people will tell you not to work with your friends. And I will tell you only work with your friends. Work takes up so much of your time. Do it with people you love, where there's also like higher stakes for like why you want to treat them well, why you want their lives to be amazing. Love them already. Like you don't have to learn to love everyone you work with.
Tell me an early specific happy childhood memory, something specific that I can relive with you.
Okay, so when I was a kid, I played sports at this place called Carrollton Boosters. I was like a full-blown little leaguer. Like I loved playing sports. I'd go down and you'd have these like hats that were way too big for you and these shirts that you'd be like rolling. And I was obsessed with a league of their own. And so I wanted to be Dottie. So I wanted to be the catcher because it was like all the action. But what I remember really vividly loving is being in the dugout and doing the cheer with the team. And you'd have these cheers that like they would be like kind of passed along. So you'd be like, my name is Cleo and I know what I got. And then like everyone would know to be like, I got, and they'd be like, so what you got? And I'd be like, I got a team that's hotter than hot. They'd be like, how hot is hot? And I'd go, Batman and Superman, can't do it like the Red Hots can, which is like the name of one of my teams. It was the name of the team that year.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone else would pick it up and I'd be like, what about you, Toots? And I did have a friend named that everyone called Toots. I actually don't know her real name. And she'd be like, my name is Toots and I know what I got. It was like something about like the heat and the dirt and the like everyone sitting on the bench watching your team and cheering. It was just so fun. And the parents were all like, it's New Orleans, so all the parents are having like the best time ever.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
So those two stories to me are the same story, which is there's an audience, there's witnesses, mm-hmm. there's the parents and there's the people who came to see you. You're there with your friends. You're doing things that haven't been done before, right? And what you're doing is leading a chant. You're bringing everybody to celebrate what they got, right? To love it and own it, no yeah. matter what it is, without comparison. If you're with people, you can do things that are difficult, hot, and dirty. Like you're in the heat, you're in the dirt, and yet you're having fun. I know the statistics that people fear public speaking, you know, sometimes more than death.
Yeah.
You know, and here you are, who you're bringing your friends on a book tour who've never done public speaking before, and you're bringing them on a stage in front of countless others, and they're enduring the heat yeah. and the dirt because they're with you and you're leading yeah. the chant, and they're with each other, and it's their safety in those numbers.
Yeah.
And I see what you do in your work, which is you're leading a chant as well. If you have that community and you have that safety, it's not an accident that you are drawn to the definition of love and safety, that when you have community, and you talk about community a lot,
yeah.
that when you build community, you can endure any dirt or heat that life has to throw at you. It makes total sense to me. It also makes total sense to me why a friend who's going through tragedy, that your instinct is to get on a plane and go there immediately to offer community to that family
yeah.
so that they can endure the heat and the dirt of whatever they're going through. This is who you are at your natural best. You're leading chants. You're
oh
leading cheers.
God.
You're leading cheers for all of us, except we're reading your poems. When you post something on Instagram and the number says, I don't know, 100,000 views, it's 100,000 of us chanting with you.
You know, it's really funny because a couple of years ago, I was doing a lot and I had really severe burnout. It was really bad. And I didn't even know. I was like, maybe I shouldn't be writing. I don't know if I want to write. And you know, I don't even know. I'd gotten pregnant with Bayou, my second kid. And I was like, I have to pause. I was like, I'm doing too many projects. I'm trying to do too many things. And I also, I don't know if I'm doing things I don't really want to do. And I say this to people all the time. I'm like, just because something's in your capacity doesn't mean it's your responsibility or your desire. So you could have this great idea, but it's like, it just might not be in your destiny to do it, even if you could see exactly how to work it out. Like, and I think so much of becoming great at something is deciding like where your energy belongs. Like, but you have to have a relationship with like belonging and self-worth to determine that. Because if not, you're constantly hijacked by like money, ideas, opportunities, and like whoever else somebody says you are. And so I was having that where I was like, I am spread so thin. I was like, I don't think I want to be making these certain things I'm making. I don't think I want to do this. And perhaps I got even hijacked by the kind of like girl boss culture of the movement of that time. And I'm saying this to my friend Shade on the phone, and I'm just like, and she's like, Cleo, I got to tell you. She's like, since the day I met you, I met her on a dance floor in New York City 15 years ago. She's like the best dancer I've ever seen. And she was like, everything you try to do for people is like, and yourself. She's like, what you love is like the home you're from. You love New Orleans as a home. And you always want to create a sense of home. You make everyone come over, even when you had that tiny little apartment. If someone was going through a hard time, you'd make them move in with you. Like, you want to bring home. And she said, so how could somebody like you build an empire? An empire is the opposite of a home. The energy is completely different. The functionality is completely different. And it changed my life in that moment. I was like, wow, I have to return home and keep inviting people in as a guest. And I don't want to like sit there and think of like, you know, I'm building a huge company and I want to just employ everybody. I was like, I actually want people to come on their like free will and be a guest. And like, I want to serve them tea.
But I think your friend is right. You're a maker of families, teams, and friends. That's exactly right.
And it's helpful to know that about yourself, because in our world, I think, especially if you want to build anything, like, people will tell you to build a company or an empire every time. And someone won't tell you that you can actually build the dream of how you want to make your money or spend your time. And you can do it in a way that feels like a home and a family.
And I think you have to do it the way that suits you. It's everything we were talking about, which is you can compare yourself to somebody else and do it their way.
Yeah.
Or you can do it your way. Yeah. And your way is to produce small magical things
mm-hmm.
that encourage us to produce small magical things, which encourage us to do small magical things. And that's how it spreads.
Yeah.
Oh, Cleo, such a treat to meet you. Truly
it's
a treat.
So
Thank
nice
you so,
meet
so much.
Thank you for having me.
Such a
this
pleasure.
So fun.
Such a pleasure.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more, please subscribe wherever you like to listen to podcasts. And if you'd like even more optimism, check out my website, simonsinek.com, for classes, videos, and more. Until then, take care of yourself, take care of each other.